Welcome to Still Untitled. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
Norm, once again, at CES.
At CES.
We haven't changed clothes since last week, so that's the big tip-off. Today, I'm going to jump right into it. No small talk today. We asked for questions several weeks ago. We got a bunch of great questions. I have gone through and culled out, I think, the seven... I don't want to say they're the best, but maybe they were the least overlapping and most interesting to answer, okay. I think.
All right.
So I'm going to get, and just in case people have other questions, if you want to email them to us, you can email them with the subject line, Adam Questions, Questions for Adam, to podcast@tested.com, and we'll do these more regularly.
We totally will.
I think this is a good feature. The first question comes from John L. I like that we did first initial last name because it gives it a whole kind of AA vibe to the whole thing. John L. wants to know, I was wondering, since you are a maker and a communicator of all things related to making, do you consider language as one of your tools, and have you had what kind, if any, of formal language education? How do you keep your skills up in your role as a communicator?
That is a great question. Language is absolutely a key part of my skill set. My formal training as a communicator is comprised of about 4 years of acting training in high school with a private teacher. I did spend 6 months pretending to go to New York University in the experimental theater wing of the Tisch School for the Arts drama department. That was what made it clear to me that that wasn't what I really wanted to do, or that I wasn't ready to pursue an ambition at that point. But I did learn some great stuff there. I also have taken a bunch of improv classes at San Francisco's local improv troupe, BATS, the Bay Area Theater Sports.
Okay.
I also, as we talked in the last podcast, tried stand-up comedy. As far as language, I also write a fair bit. This whole year, I've been writing a column for Wired Magazine. I've written columns for Popular Mechanics. I've written on Tested. And every one of those exercises requires me to figure out ways to say things that are interesting. And especially when you're writing, especially when you're doing magazine writing, you've got to be tight, you've got to stay on point, and you've got to think of many, many ways to say something.
If you want to make 450 words seem like not many words, write a magazine column that 150 or 200,000 people are going to read and make sure that it's interesting.
It is a fantastic exercise in language because I notice all these proclivities about myself. I just wrote this long article for Popular Mechanics, which they're editing right now. But it was talking about stuff about 10 different movies. And I ran out of adjectives by the third one. and my exercise in writing it was that I wrote them all out in a couple of days really fast. And then I read them a day later and I thought, these are all terrible. And so I went and I started to hack them apart, and a couple were good, and a couple finessed them one at a time, went back the next day, still all of them terrible. Again, did it, you know, and each time I'm going in and I'm seeing things like, oh, I often use the passive tense. I often give way too much of an introduction to a sentence that I'm about, that I don't need to.
Yeah. Or you're using weak. I mean, my thing is I use the same weak adjectives, and I don't, they don't start out as weak adjectives, but I make them weak adjectives by overuse.
Yes. And I'm always, every now and then I'll be running out of adjectives and I'll want to use the word wonderful. And I'm remembering, Strunk.
Yeah. Strunk and White.
Strunk and White. Yeah. He actually has a paragraph about how the word wonderful is a useless
verboten
word.
Yeah.
Totally verboten.
Strunk and, so if you want to learn about writing, my advice has always been Strunk and White it's the thinnest book you'll ever read.
It's the greatest. I've read it 4 or 5 times over my life.
It's The Elements of Style. It is a wonderful, wonderful book. They give it to you as a freshman in pretty much every English comp class that I've ever heard of in college.
And there's a beautiful edition for sale right now in bookstores.
It's
a hardcover, orange cover with illustrations inside, but it's magnificently printed. It's luxurious to read and it's not that expensive.
And E.B. White, just to be clear, is E.B. White from Stuart Little and Charlotte's Web. I don't know who Strunk is. There was an article about him in the Atlantic or something.
If I remember correctly, like one of E.B. White's teachers or an early mentor.
Or maybe it's the other way around.
Could be. Yeah. But I believe E.B. White came second.
Okay.
But I could be wrong.
But the idea is it's all about simplicity in language and using fewer words when you have, you know,
and ways of using fewer
exactly
words, and ways of thinking about using fewer words, not using the passive tense, etc.
Being precise and being concise. I also like Stephen King's book on writing. It's really good.
His nonfiction is some of the best stuff he's ever written. So writing helps me a lot in communicating, in thinking.
You also do a lot of speaking, though, too.
I do a lot of speaking. And in speaking, one of the greatest tools I have learned for choosing my words carefully is not being afraid to pause. When you're up on stage in front of a bunch of people, it's easy to feel like when you stop talking, that time starts moving incredibly fast. And then you start to panic.
And then you go faster and faster and faster.
Or you do the classic thing that people do when they're not when they don't feel like they're getting enough feedback. And you don't ever really get enough feedback from an audience. I mean, think about you telling a dinner party a joke and no one laughs. It's like being in front of an audience is that times 10.
But, yeah. Except for they're all in their underwear.
You think the pauses are lasting a long period of time, but they are so not lasting a long period of time. And you don't have to panic. You can actually relax. And the more you relax, the more your audience will relax, and the more you'll actually get feedback from them.
Well, and especially if you're talking about something complex, then giving them a moment to process what you're talking about isn't – it's not like it's a Steve Martin act where he's just constantly building and never giving any release. Giving people a moment to think is not a bad thing necessarily.
Totally true. Oh, the thing I was going to say that people do when they're nervous is, and I find so many people do this, they repeat what they say three times. They go, yeah, so I bought that at the Best Buy. I went to the Best Buy and I bought it. It was a Saturday. I went over to Best Buy and I bought it. And you'll find conversationally, if you start to look for this, I told this to Penn Jillette on his podcast, Penn Sunday School. And about 10 minutes later, Penn told me something three times. Well, I'm not saying Penn was nervous. I don't think Penn gets nervous. But it's like a conversational tick.
It's a tick. It's stalling for time while they compose the next part of the sentence is coming up. I apologize. That was terrible.
I appreciate the guy the questioner saying I'm a communicator. That's actually something I didn't realize was one of my jobs until fairly recently. I mean, if you'd asked me, I would have said, "Oh, of course I'm a communicator." But I was doing Neil deGrasse Tyson's podcast in New York last year, and I was looking at some of his stuff just to kind of reacquaint myself with some of his best pieces, and some of his best writing, and some of his best public speaking, and thinking, man, this guy has really just taken it on. I am going to get the world more interested in what's awesome about science. And I thought, no, that's one of my jobs too.
Yeah. I mean, it's the big part. I think, I mean, blowing stuff up is easy. Making people interested about science and building stuff is a lot harder, I think.
And actually talking about how we're going to talk about stuff is one of the places where we argue back and forth the most because it's the hardest part of our job.
Next question. This one is from Jordan P. Hi, Jordan. After listening to you guys talk about your favorite movies and books, have you ever thought about penning a novel or screenplay?
Yes.
Like in the shower thinking about it outlining?
So I did actually, it's funny, about 6 weeks ago, I wrote the first like five paragraphs of my imitation of an Elmore Leonard novel. Just because I love the opening. I love Elmore Leonard. I've read every book he's written. And he's one of my favorite authors, and there is no better writer of dialogue Tarantino will even say that.
But Tarantino lifts from him
completely.
I mean, to the point that he made a movie.
Yeah. No, and Jackie Brown is, while having very little to do with Rum Punch, its original material, the most faithful adaptation of an Elmore Leonard novel. And there's some great stuff out there: Out of Sight, Get Shorty, etc. At any rate, Elmore Leonard opens his books always, you know, the whole thing about like start late, start in the middle of the action. Leonard always does.
And jumps right in.
So that was just an exercise, was playing around with writing. As far as the screenplay, absolutely I have thought about screenplays. My wife and I talk about them a lot. We talk about plots. We talk about getting one and, you know, getting together and writing one.
When you read screenplays, I mean, for entertainment value.
I've read a lot of screenplays for entertainment value. Yeah. And I'm fascinated with the form, and it is totally, I recognize it is not an easy form. A lot of people are led to believe, because it's 100 pages and the words are spaced far apart, that in some way it's an easier form of writing. Not.
Dialogue is really hard to write, just in general.
And if you think that screenplay writing is easy, you must know that you don't understand it enough. You just need to know that.
Well, it's easy to write a really terrible screenplay.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
No, that's
I mean, just true. To be clear.
Yes, to be clear. I have actually written a screenplay years ago with a buddy of mine. We wrote a screenplay called Andy and Vincent Rob the MoMA, about a couple of down-at-heel artists who rob the Museum of Modern Art in order to get famous. And they do it dressed as Andy Warhol and Vincent Van Gogh.
So, and it stars Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson. And,
Well, we actually ended up filming a trailer with us in it. It's somewhere out there in the world.
Is it on YouTube?
It might be. I haven't seen it in years. It's not a bad trailer. It was pretty cool. We shot it, I think, in like 95, 96, something like that.
The thing to me, because I sat down and started on novels a couple times and ended up writing really nice short stories that I never showed anyone, you know, because that's what you do with them.
Yeah.
The market for short stories is kind of grim these days. The writing novels is writing novels the way I write short stories is a fairly significant challenge in getting, like, the complexity level is way beyond what I normally,
yeah,
what I normally write. I like writing tight and concise and all the stuff we talked about in the last question.
Yeah.
And you kind of get into more descriptive stuff in a way that I'm profoundly not good at, as a writer. So it's a different challenge.
It is. And you know, my favorite writers are all, what I would refer to as linear writers. Tarantino is one. I don't know if Elmore Leonard knows the end of his books when he starts, but I know that Tarantino rarely figures out the ending of his movies in the middle. And Raymond Chandler, my favorite author of all time.
They're character guys. I mean, they know characters, and then they see what happens.
And to me, that's how, if I was to write a novel, and when I think about screenplays, I always start with a character. A story, and the story I recognize is completely paramount. Mm-hmm. But the story is driven by the character, not the other way.
If the characters aren't interesting, the best story in the world isn't going to save them.
Precisely. And if the story is not interesting, the most beautiful movie in the world is not interesting. Case in point, I saw Total Recall.
The new one.
The new one.
I don't know what you're talking about.
It's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
It's gorgeous. It's actually, the art direction is beautiful. Boy, is that director paying his homage to Blade Runner, including lifting entire sequences from Blade Runner and just putting them in his
movie.
Wow. Zora running through the glass,
uh-huh,
totally in Total Recall.
Wow.
In futuristic, kind of Los Angeles.
Some bad CG in the background,
but there's,
I'm sure.
Actually, it's beautiful CG. And the world that he builds around the characters, wooden and uninteresting as they are, is a beautiful world.
Well, I mean, just to be clear, the first movie wasn't a good movie.
No,
it was an awesome movie.
I can't stand the first
movie. Oh, it's fantastic. They suck the air out of Mars. Oh, it's ridiculous on so many different levels.
I can't stand the original
Total. I might have been the right age when that movie came out to really be able to appreciate
that's
it.
That's entire. Well, yeah.
Because I'm, you know, yeah. I don't want to think that movie exists. I'm going to go ahead and just.
I don't really think seriously about writing a novel. When I read my favorite authors like Chandler or Chabon, I am in such awe of what they're able to achieve and the places they're able to take me that I don't imagine. And I recognize that one shouldn't start to try and write a novel with the idea that you're going to somehow be at the level of your favorite writers. But I don't feel like that's a place that I plan to go. Who knows? Anything's possible, though.
Well, and it requires a level. I mean, on some side, writing a novel is 3 months of work if you write 1,000 words a day, and you know, right?
If you're Neil Gaiman,
right, right. Well, or if you're Charlie Strauss or one of those guys who's banging out 5,000 word days, and you're like, wow, you are just a bastard.
Stephen King.
Yeah, it's. I'm not a 5,000 words a day guy on the best of days.
No.
So, the next question comes from Seth B. Seth says, a few weeks ago, you mentioned that you meditate an hour before you go to sleep every night. I'm curious about meditation. I was wondering how and why you got into meditation and made it a part of your daily routine.
So I will stop this rumor before it goes any further. I don't meditate an hour before I go to bed every night. Occasionally, when I have trouble sleeping, I will meditate for a while. And that will often help me go right to sleep.
The problem with podcasts is you frequently will catch the last half of a sentence. And yeah.
So I first got into meditation. I was 25 and I had moved into a large studio space down in the Bayview in Hunters Point. and I had taken a job to do a bunch of large-scale props for a party thrower.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy had hired me to build 16 large-scale props. And
like tiki fountains and stuff like that? Or
a book that you walked through to get into the party. Massive sculpted topiary with Christmas lights on it and stuff. And we did. We had planned to do it in three blocks. We had planned to do this job in three blocks. So I was finishing up the first block, and I was realizing I am in way over my head. I don't have enough time or energy to do the other two parts of this job. But the first one is happening. He's advanced me a bunch of the dough to do it. And I called him up, and I said, hey, listen, the first job is coming along nicely. However, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do the other two parts. I want to talk about it right now because I just thought about this. I'd like to take those off my plate so I can concentrate on this, but I just wanted you to know. His response was to A, cancel the advance check he had given me, against which I had bought $3,000 worth of materials, and then not return my calls for 10 days.
Wow.
I still had a job to finish too.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was finishing this job. My girlfriend at the time, had just moved in with me, and I ended up borrowing $3,000 from her, which is always
great. It's a great way to set that off. Yeah, exactly.
And I started feeling a constant pain in my stomach. I started getting, a stress ulcer.
Anxiety pain, yeah.
Anxiety pain. And a friend of mine was an accomplished martial artist, had been training for 15 years, even at that point, in his early 20s, had been doing it forever. And had done a lot of meditation. And so I asked him about it. He just, at the very most rudimentary way, say, if you've never tried meditation before, look, you can just sit there and just about thinking about your breath. Your goal is to turn your mind off. Your goal is to concentrate on something other than all the thoughts that are keeping you from being able to think clearly. And so he said, one technique is a quiet breath where you try and breathe as quietly and as softly. Oh, that's my phone ringing.
Line one.
We're just going to let it ring.
Yeah, that's fine.
Breathe as quietly and as softly as you possibly can and stay really concentrated on that. And that actually worked for me. It worked quite well for me. When I say it worked for me, I was able to do some concentrating. Meditation is a total exercise in failure because your body aches and your mind wanders just constantly.
It's very hard to sit still and do nothing.
We are messes.
Yeah.
We are bags of meat and water.
Right.
And
squirrel.
Right. And however, it did have a small but appreciable effect on my stress level. And ever since then, at times of stress and times when I can't sleep because things are happening and in my life I endure a fair bit of stress.
Anyone who works on regular deadlines feels constant stress.
And, twin 13-year-old boys,
that's a whole other source of stress.
Yeah. I find meditation is a very nice respite from that. And even, Gandhi says it may feel that what you're doing is insignificant, but it's vital that you do it. Just the exercise and taking time out for your brain to chill out is in and of itself an important exercise.
Well, and in the world with these things and phones and tablets and podcasts, the amount of mental downtime that I had when I was 15 years old versus when I'm 37 years old, it has gone from nigh infinite to, the time between when I walk out of the front door of the car and get in the car.
Yes, and turn on NPR.
Yeah, and then the shower's on when I'm in the shower and I'm singing quietly to myself. And I think that, there's been a lot of, there was a New York Times story about this a few weeks ago that we should talk about on a separate episode at some point. But the tyranny of being busy, like the best stuff I've always come up with comes when I'm not thinking about anything in particular.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and that's where the most, and if you take away that time to not think about anything in particular, then you lose that.
And one of my wife and I have learned through hard experience that while we like to travel and we love staying in nice places and eating in great places around the country, around the world, that our favorite vacation is to stay here and not do anything, watch movies, cook for ourselves, and literally look up and realize, oh my God, it's 2:00.
Be comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a little, something to be said about having your own slippers and not the fancy hotel slippers.
So that being said, I have, although we take the fancy hotel slippers, so we have them here.
Okay, yeah. That's good.
If you stay in our guest room in this house, mm-hmm. you will find soap and shampoo on your bed and slippers by the side.
A pillow mint?
Yeah.
Oh, beautiful.
So yeah, meditation has the rudimentary version that I do has provided me some great succor over the years.
That's fantastic. Next question is from Joel. Joel says, I recently discovered that there's a gag prop newspaper that has been doing the rounds for many years in the TV and movie industry.
Oh, yes.
I'm interested to know if Adam is aware of or has had any experience with similar props or gags during his time in the industry.
Yeah, there's a name for that type of house. There are printing facilities that make fake magazines, newspapers, candy wrappers, sodas, and all sorts of products that can populate the newsstands and stores of television reality.
Back in the old days before it was all product placement and Jerry Seinfeld started drinking Snapple.
Right. But yeah. Even now, these places, there are several of these places. Yeah, there's a Metafilter thread from only a couple of days ago about these places. That may be what he's referring to.
Oh, no, this is from 3 weeks ago. Oh, okay. So, yeah.
So what he should know is that there's a Metafilter thread. Metafilter.net, uh-huh. One of my favorite places online for news and information.
It's like Reddit from the 90s.
It is like Reddit from the 90s, and also
The Metafilter guys are going to tear me apart for saying that.
Well, but no. Here's the difference is actually quite significant, and they both have their merits. Reddit is an ungoverned melee.
The narco-cynics.
And I love it for what it is. Metafilter is rigorously moderated. And the moderators on Reddit are really brilliant at what they do, and they keep a tight watch on the community, and it really is a community. There's a lot of really regular posters. Discussions, even when you disagree with them, are always very cogent and well thought out. I will say the interest of full disclosure, Matt Howey is a friend of mine who started Metafilter, mm-hmm. but it's one of my favorite places on the web.
But
wait, agreed. What was the original question?
The question was newspaper.
Right. The gag props. Yeah, so there's a whole industry of gag props out there, of gag products populating television. I would love some of those things because on Mythbusters, we're constantly blacking out and geeking out logos, even down to they asked us to somehow obscure the labels on car tires. So you know what we... I can't remember who figured it out, but we use that spray stuff that supposedly will turn a screen door into a boat bottom.
Oh, like the filler, the goop filler stuff?
Yeah. Spray that on a tire, and like an hour later, you can't read what's on the tire.
Wow.
But that's the degree to which we have to obscure that the world exists.
When we first started working with you guys, and I think Jamie said, is it okay if we leave the blah, blah, blah logo on this thing? And I said, yeah, it's the internet. Nobody's willing to pay for that.
Well, that's not going to last very long.
Yeah, exactly. Mark D says, I have a 4.5-year-old boy and he's very inquisitive. He's at the stage of his life where he asks me tons of questions, rarely repeats any of his questions. He simply absorbs the answer and moves on. I would love to take this opportunity to start little projects and have my son learn along with me. He's still pretty young at 4.5, but kids often surprise us how well they can learn even at that age. He is looking for any simple but fun projects he can do with his son or suggestions for books or stuff like that.
Well, I mean, first and foremost, there's Legos.
Lego's great.
Lego is
kind of expensive.
Kind of expensive, it's true, but the sets for 4-year-olds are the least expensive sets.
Well, and there's other alternatives to Lego for building, especially at that age, stuff like I think Lincoln Logs is good for under 5.
Yeah, yeah. And there's problem solving to do. Nobody's directions are perfect.
Yeah.
Even Legos, even when I build Lego sets now, I leave pieces out because
they always ship extra pieces.
I know they do. But I still know that I'm leaving.
Oh, okay. You still whiffed. Okay. Fair enough.
There's also a lot of really great papercraft out on the web, and I'm a huge proponent of papercraft. It's how I learned to build everything.
Mm-hmm.
There were these books when I was younger called The World at Your Feet by an amazing architect named Alan Rose, who still lives in New York City. And you could build, it's a book that you could build the Taj Mahal with. And this wasn't die cut, pop out, and fold along the lines. This was raw sheets of paper with the image printed on them, and you had to cut them out with X-Acto blades and score them and fold them.
I remember that. It looked terrifying.
I built all of those.
Wow.
And the thing about papercraft that is really great is that it's really easy on a rudimentary level for a kid to understand how a box gets cut out and made. But once you start to build compound curves with papercraft, and there's, by the way, if you search papercraft and then anything that you're interested in, someone will have made it. Although I'm still waiting for someone to design a papercraft of the bathhouse from Spirited Away because I want to build one. But there are papercraft Millennium Falcons, papercraft TIE Fighters, papercraft Battlestar Galactica ships, buildings, all sorts of stuff. And you start to understand compound curves and you really get at the very most basic level planar forms meeting each other under certain constrictions. Mm-hmm. And once you understand that, you will understand the rudiments of carpentry, sewing, welding, all of that stuff.
Once you can turn a 2D image into a 3D shape, and you also get a lot better standardized tests too, it turns out.
Exactly.
I would say look for stuff at your local museums too. If you have science and aviation mm-hmm. museums, kids museums, they're a great source of information. A lot of them have bookshops online, so they'll have books that have that stuff. We met John Collins, who's the paper airplane guy at thepaperairplaneguy.com last year. And he sells both books and website stuff where you can learn how to fold amazing paper airplanes that will teach him about aeronautics and stability, flight stability and characteristics of flight for paper airplanes. There's literally things like that on every single topic out there from stuff like that all the way down to robotics that you build with Duplo blocks. So
yeah. There's a lot out there.
Bookstore museums, or museum bookstores rather, online resources
for the are also Instructables. Mm-hmm. Make has some great stuff that goes all the way from little kids.
The Geek Dad stuff that Ken I can't remember his last name, but Ken over at Wired is doing is great. I mean, that's a great blog to look at, and that rate that kind of skews a little bit older, I think, than mm-hmm. 4.5. But
and I don't know how young they skew over at the Tinker School, Gaver Tully's summer camp. Gaver Tully did the TED Talk 10 Dangerous Things You Should Let Your Kids Do. It's a great TED Talk.
He has a book too, right?
He has a book, 50 Dangerous Things You Should Let Your Kids Do. He runs a summer camp called the Tinker School where he guarantees your kid will come home bruised and cut.
Perfect. Mooned the children.
And he actually has a school here in San Francisco called Brightworks, which is a DIY maker-based learning school, and it's a wonderful place.
I think the more stuff you do, at that point, I think just exposing your kid to as much stuff as you can.
Honestly,
is
building
great.
Something in front of the kid is also, I learned a lot from just sitting in my dad's studio watching him paint.
I learned from, hey, would you get me the 3/8 inch uh-huh. wrench? Right,
yeah,
like
exactly.
By the time I was 12, I was really tired of getting the 3/8 inch wrench, but I had learned a lot along the way. And as I'm doing more stuff now that I haven't looked at in 25 years, I realize, hey, I know how to do a bunch of stuff with carpentry and automobile repair just from watching Dad do that stuff for 10 years.
So, totally.
Yeah. That stuff's great. A couple more questions.
Okay.
Barry M wants to know, hey, have any of the germ related myths you've tested changed your behavior in any way? For example, do you eat dip out of a bowl that someone else has double dipped into?
Are you kidding? Not only do I do that, mm-hmm. I double dip in every bowl I get near.
Oh, that completely changes the dynamic of eating at the Savage House.
Absolutely. I'm an unabashed double dipper.
So those lessons have stuck with you.
Well, not just about that. But. Oh, no, actually, I was always a double dipper. I just now do it with total permission.
Okay, so no qualms whatsoever.
It's funny. We're just about to do some germ myths about bathrooms, about public restrooms.
Have you done the phone? Is the phone's dirtier than the urinal?
I think that Cary Grant and Tori did something like that. I know that Cary Byron removes the top blanket from every hotel room she's in completely.
Yeah,
uses the one in the closet.
Yeah,
and like disinfects the remote.
I don't ever touch the TV remote in the hotel room, ever.
I lick it. That's because what's my immune system for?
Well, that's true. I mean, if you want to really strengthen the immune system, we can get onto the bar station. You can lick the turnstiles.
Right, there you go. There is one thing that I do, and it's just more of like an intellectual exercise, which is that after I wash my hands in the bathroom,
mm-hmm.
I use the towels to open the door.
Of course.
Or I open the door from the lowest possible point. It's not because I really care. It's just that I'm interested in the exercise of what's the least germ-ridden part of the handle of a bathroom door.
Well, the thing I think about is probably the filthiest part of the bathroom is the faucet and the urinal flusher, right? Those are the things that people handle after, before washing.
True. But then the handle of the door would be right
and
up
then,
there.
Well,
and all bathroom doors open in, which requires you to grab something to get out.
I found people have started putting towel trash cans by the door now, though.
Well, I remember seeing years ago a germ specialist with Matt Lauer, who is himself a noted germaphobe.
Yeah.
They even found evidence of candida on an escalator railing.
So this is a fun experiment. You can go to Amazon. You can buy a bunch of Petri dishes.
Yeah.
It'll be $15 for 30 of them or something like that. They're very inexpensive. Go get some sterile swabs. You can get those at any drugstore or anywhere pretty much. You can use Q-tips if you open a fresh pack. And then just walk around your house, swipe stuff, take the gel, run the swab through it, close it up, put it in a kind of cool, dark, warm, dark place, and then come back a week and make sure you label each one, obviously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then look and see what's grown there.
You'll be amazed.
Don't eat, because sometimes bad stuff will grow. it's fascinating, and you get a wide variety of tons of different. I mean, there's yellow bacteria, and there's green bacteria, and there's black bacteria, and there's mold and fungus and all sorts.
Yeah.
It's really fun. It'll teach your kid. Microbiology was the class that terrified me more than anything else in college, I think.
I love the germ stuff that we do on the show. It's some of my favorite stuff, and I'm impressed that it has regularly rated so high with the fans, because from a raw televisual standpoint, it's difficult to make great television swabbing and Petri dish cooking.
We did the swabbing and Petri dish, and I got done. And I was like, well, I don't know how we make a video out of this.
Right.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you know, we've been able to figure it out. And like I said, we're just about to do bathrooms and one other thing, which I can't quite remember.
From my inaccurate swabbing, the inside of the urinal, because it's cleaned every day, was much, much cleaner than the door handle on the way out.
Oh, absolutely. So, absolutely.
Think about that, guys.
Yeah.
One more question.
Last question.
Bill Doran, who is a friend of the site, he is Punished Props. He makes video game props.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And an RPF guy.
I'm a big fan of his work.
He does awesome stuff.
I want to get him to make me a Daft Punk helmet.
Oh no, that's Harrison Chris at Vulpin.
I've got them.
But Bill's a protege.
Okay.
They're in different parts of the country, but I think Harrison breaking out and quitting his day job and doing this inspired Bill to do the same thing.
Copy.
Bill is a prop maker. He says, I'm a prop maker who builds mostly replicas from video games. That provides a different set of advantages and challenges compared to trying to introduce something from a movie, for example, the Bourne bag. I was curious if Adam has ever made anything from a video game, and this is for the three of us. Sorry, Norm. If you could build some kind of prop weapon vehicle environment from a video game, what would it be?
Oh, that's a really good question.
So have you ever thought about, I mean, the video games that you, I mean, I guess some of that 8-bit pixel art or the early arcade stuff makes really cool laser cut
and you can do
really neat stuff with that.
And I like it. I appreciate it, and it makes me laugh in the right way. I'm not interested in making that stuff for myself. I do have, along those lines, on the RPF every now and then, there are guys who make life-size Lego versions of props, like the lightsaber. I just bought a couple of Batarangs.
The Lego lightsaber is awesome.
Yeah, it's totally awesome.
It is amazing.
From video games, it's interesting. If I was going to... So, I mean, again, we've talked about this. I'm not a big video game player. I've played a bunch of Unreal Tournament when I worked at ILM with the other laser cutting guys there. Mm-hmm. I played Myst and Riven.
But none of those games really lend themselves. Like, there's no... I mean, I guess the books in Myst, but without the
actually,
screens...
It's a funny story that lots of people don't know. The big knife that sticks in the ground that mm-hmm. falls over at the end of Riven... If you get all the way to the end.
I didn't make it to the end of Riven.
I didn't either, but I know about it because I actually built that knife. I made when they did Riven, they did a mixture of CG and live action. And for the knife falling over, mm-hmm. I actually built a like 5-foot long practical prop that they filmed on set.
Wow.
Falling over. And strangely enough, when I did the Rally to Restore Sanity and or Fear, one of Colbert's writers that I met was one of the producers on that Riven who had hired Jamie Heineman's shop to build that thing, and I was the model maker.
Oh,
and
that's
here
funny.
We were coming full circle.
Wow.
I know.
It's a tiny little world.
So if I was going to have something, you know, I really like over-the-top weaponry. Some of my favorite weird guns are like Iria's gun from Z-Ram, which is a very Japanese live action sort of anime crazy nuts.
Is it like enormous swords and stuff like that?
Yeah,
anime,
guns with like millions of things sticking out of them, but beautiful
like Keshern kind of stuff. Yeah,
yeah,
okay.
You know, I'm a huge fan of the design of the designs of Jean-Giraud Mobius, that kind of stuff. I've really, really loved all the portal gun builds that I've seen. I've been wanting one. I just haven't gotten around to getting one.
Well, Harrison only did one of those.
Yeah.
I think he did one and then he did a mirror image or something of that. And he did the Half-Life gravity gun a couple years later, which is
right.
Maybe it was the other order. I can't remember. But they were packs. They were sold in the PAX auction. Well, a friend of ours has actually bought one of those, I think.
What is the video game that takes place like in the city underwater?
Oh, Bioshock.
Bioshock.
Okay. Yeah, it's on the list. When we asked for games that people thought you should play, Bioshock was very, very high on that
list. I tried playing a little bit of Bioshock.
Okay.
And I thought the props and the pieces and the look of that were absolutely gorgeous.
It's very gamey.
It is very gamey and, you know, super steampunk. And what you should know about me, and I don't know, maybe I should put up some of my early sculpture on to test it, because what you should know is that I was doing steampunk in like 1990.
When people were really using that as technology still. Yes,
exactly.
You were building functional steampunk prototypes.
Precisely.
Well, that's great. Yeah, Bioshock is a lovely art style, but it might be too much of a video game.
I love I'll tell you the other thing that I love, and if someone came out with them, I would certainly purchase them, is like books. You know, Riven is full of the books that he's finding and the books that things are being written in them. I love that kind of stuff.
The custom bound, handmade, gorgeous books. Yeah.
I totally, totally love that kind of stuff. So for me, it's hard to know, but we should review the video game suggestions that we got. And I should play one.
Well, once we're back from the, I think, but we can do that one of two ways.
Yeah.
We should talk about it off air, but I think we'll either play one game and make each show one game and talk it through and try to play for 30 or 40 minutes or whatever. Or we can do a condensed, as many as we can cram into an hour.
I think we should do one game.
I think one per is a better approach. But and that'll do it for questions.
That'll do it for questions. By the way, my talisman for this podcast is my beautiful replica of the bride's sword from Kill Bill, made by a friend of mine up in Canada, in Montreal. It is in every way an exact replica of the shooting swords. Even down, all the findings and fixings were purchased from the same suppliers that the prop makers bought from, and the lioness, the badge here, and the food dog on the blade were all hand etched by his CNC machine, and we worked very hard on these graphics to make them as accurate as possible. It is
something like literally. We'll pause a minute and show it at the camera at the very end.
Yes,
and then Norm's going to come take pictures at some point.
Perfect.
It is gorgeous.
It is a really beautiful piece.
It is of all the stuff that I mean, you have Adam. You've collected a ton of neat stuff over the years. This is the winner.
Yeah, I love this thing.
Maybe the Maltese Falcon.
The Maltese Falcon and the Blade Runner gun.
And the Blade. Those are all pretty good. I mean, they're okay.
Because I made those.
Yes.
I didn't make this.
Fair enough. We'll see you guys next week. As always, we would love reviews on iTunes.
Absolutely.
If you want to find us on Twitter, Adams, don't try this. The tested is tested.com. I'm Will Smith. Norm's N Chan. What else do we normally do? Facebook, YouTube, all that stuff. You can find us all over the place. I think we're on Zune now too.
Oh, fantastic!
Those Xbox Music is what it's called now.
Xbox Music.
And we'll be back next week with another episode of Still Untitled. See you guys later.
Bye.